I'm Pancho, I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be here, and the God of my understanding to have another day. I'm kind of nervous, which I'm usually not, but I was telling my friend Bill here that asked me to share, and some other individuals over here, I attend a lot of AA meetings, and the literature he's talking about, I work out of another program. So I can't refer to this book here because I'll be honest with you, I don't use that book. I use another book, okay? But the program that I come from, I know this is a grandfather program, and I'm grateful for this program. Now, I've had an opportunity that with 100 days clean, I was taken to a spiritual retreat over in San Ynez, over in the Bay Area, Santa Barbara, that area, and was introduced to a lot of people that had some time and talked about, how important AA was, because at that time the other program was brand new and we didn't have no literature. So, I have to say that I'm going to try and stay in the traditions as I possibly can, and if by any chance you feel offended, I'll make my amends right now, okay? My experience, my strength, and my hope, my experience I used for 30 years. I drank. I got clean when I was 43. That's 2-10-01. I believe, if you don't know your clean date, I asked somebody that, and he was, it's about, or more or less, I know my clean date. My clean date to me is the most important thing, more important than my belly button. And it's because, without that, I wouldn't have nothing. I know that. The very first thing I had to do was to stop putting alcohol in my system. That was the very first thing, and I don't know about any of you, I didn't see that as my problem. It was always either them or her, somebody's always blaming somebody else. They didn't know, they didn't understand. I was different. All these things that we hear here, and when we come in here and we look for all the differences. Now, I got clean in this area. I'm not originally from here. I'm originally from Southern California. And when I came in, I came to a new meeting at the Lano Club. Okay? 8.5 years ago. And I walked in and I looked now right here and I could see some color. Okay? But when I went into the Lano Club, that new meeting, I looked around and I said, it might work for white people, but I sure don't look like it works for brown people. Because ain't nobody was there but me. And like I said, I looked for all the differences. He's probably a snitch. His old lady probably tells him what to do. Okay? I can tell she wears the pants in the house. This was all the things that I seen. All the differences. And then, of course, I've seen some things that attracted me. They say this program is about attraction and not promotion. I see the nice cars. I've seen the nice ladies, the watches. And because where I come from, those things were important to me. And if I couldn't have them the right way, I'd get them whatever way I could. That's just the way it was. And reality, the thing was that I come from a family that taught me values and morals and hard work. I mean, I can say that, growing up in Southern California, that I had the need to go and be on the streets or run around in the streets. In fact, I was raised in a little town called Azusa, which in the county of Los Angeles, this is the 60s that I'm growing up, in the 70s, and my cousins from Los Angeles, from the downtown area, would say that we were country folk. Okay? Because, where I grew up, I remember, 6-7 years old, the last street on the neighborhood right there was Pasadena, there was an orange grove. And so, you know, I can say that that I had to be on, you know, running the streets, making money, this and that. I'm a come from 10. Five boys, five girls, and I'm the youngest. So I was a fortunate one. I had a car when I was in eighth grade. Okay? That's how fortunate I was. You know, one of my younger older brothers gave it to me. You know, and you see, I had a father that was an alcoholic, was a big-time enabler, codependent, and, you know, taught me the best he could was what was taught to him. You know. He became, from an orange picker, like I said, we come from Southern California, and that's what he did. You know. During the war, went to work at Santa Anita Racetrack. From there, he helped build the Santa Fe Dam, which is right there in San Gabriel Valley. And then in 1948, he got his contractor's license for farm labor. Started running crews. And he bought his first truck in 1949. So, you know, he built up a business. He was a farm labor contractor, had a trucking business. And as the citrus came this way from Southern California, he started coming this way. He'd come and then we'd go back. You know, finally the house was sold over there in 1986. When I finally stood over here, because I paroled over here. And I believe this is important because, like I said, I remember coming over here in the summer from over there. And I said, it was okay, but he would make me go out and go work in the field. He would tell my older brother that was running the crew, take him with you, you know, swamp boxes, load grapes. And I said, man, why do I got to do this? You got money, just give it to me. You know, like I said, I don't know about any of you, I've always looked for the faster, the shorter, the easiest way. That's always been, you know, the route that I take. You know, so why do I got to work hard for it? And so I was taught that the value of the dollar, the value of work, the value of being honest. He would tell me a lot of stories of my grandfather, how there was no better feeling than walking down Main Street, that my grandfather told him, with his hat placed on his head right, and be able to stop in any store that he liked and pull out his wallet and with hard-earned money buy whatever he wanted. And there's been hustle since man began. And, you know, I guess back then, too, you know, there was always different ways to make money. Because instead of somebody, if you made that money the wrong way, somebody would come and tell you, and you were purchasing something, and they knew how you acquired that money, would tell you, yeah, he can buy it, but you know how you got it. And he would tell me stuff like that, and at the time, I was like, hey, old man, what are you talking about? This is the 70s. Okay. Talking about when you grew up in the 20s in Los Angeles and you know, the Depression and, you know, what has that got to do with me? You know, I remember him telling me, what is right is right and what is wrong and that will never change. He told me, I mean, for being a man that only went up to a sophomore in high school, and for someone to do that back then, that was a great accomplishment. You know, he was a very intelligent man, but he loved his alcohol and he loved his women. And I don't know how my mom stood married to him 50 plus years. Okay? Because he liked that whiskey and he liked them women, like I said, you know. And so, growing up, I seen my older cousins, I seen my older brothers, how they worked hard and they had things and they had their house and they had their family, but they always seemed to have a girlfriend on the side. And I'm saying this because I thought, well, hey, this is, I guess, how you live life. When I grew up, I'm supposed to do the same thing. Okay? It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't talked about, it wasn't said, but you know, hey, I've seen it. And I say this because it wasn't until I got sober and then I got some sobriety, because I know one thing, I know the two difference Okay? There's a difference there. And the other fellowship, we thought we'd take about being clean and being in recovery. And those are two different things. Way two different things. And so, this is important because, like I said, I always thought, well, you know, hey, I would hear things from my family after I started getting into the disease, and I didn't even know I had a disease. You know, I started about the age of 12, 13. You know, when I'm growing up, you know, there was, the booze was a given. I remember drinking Ripple, okay, because it was cheap. Spinata, okay? Big old bottles like that, right? And in school, they would sell these nickel bags of all kinds of different colored pills, which way you want to go, okay? And all kinds of other stuff, you know? So, you know, it was just that era. And so I experimented with all that, okay? And I found my chemical of choice, and it wasn't none of those. You know, it was one of those that gave me instant gratification, okay? Because those other things took too long. It took too long to drink, and you have to drink so much, and you have to take all that other stuff, and by the time they hit you, and when I found that one that went straight to the main line, I fell in love. And of course, they told me and they warned me, you know, hey, all kinds of things are going to happen. They happen to you because you don't know better. I know better. I'm smarter than you. Okay? So I'm going to be able to... I graduated from high school. Tell the truth, I don't even know how I graduated from high school. Okay. I went to a trade school. I know how to do commercial and residential electrical wiring. I pulled underground. I worked with 660. I did all this when I was young, but I just wasn't, you know, to my liking. My dad didn't want me to drive truck. And That was my thing. I could drive a bobtail when I was 11, 12 years old. And so I left all that, and I got behind the wheel of the truck. And for me, that was the best thing, because I was never in the same place on any given day. You know, and I had nobody looking over my shoulder. So I could do whatever I wanted. You know. And what I did know that by the age of 21, I would be sitting in a prison cell. And when they told me that too, I had gentlemen told me that, and I told them, I'm not going to prison. I'm not stupid like you. You're going to prison because, you know, you don't know what you're doing. But he was right. And that totally, how would I say, the belief system that I had at one time, which was right, and it was going sideways. After I went there, it just went totally a different way. You know, I learned there that I couldn't have a compassion or empathy for my fellow man. Okay? And so, even though I didn't like doing that, I had to do it to survive. So what I did when I was in there to get rid of that feeling of after I would hurt somebody, you know, there was always tuna. I learned how to make that too in there too, from an old guy, you know, because it was just something that it worked. You know, if you did it good, I could get a 16-ounce tumbler and down it, and you could feel it, you know, if you knew what you were doing. So I always found a way to change the way I felt. And that was one of the things that I guess probably the biggest lie that I would tell myself, that I did what I did because I liked it. Well, you know, in the beginning I did like it. When I was in junior high and in the beginning of high school, I liked it. It was good. I had great times, good times. But after, like I said, I found that drug of choice at 19, and then it became work. You know, it wasn't about, yeah, there were still good times, but there was always, you know, I have to be at work, and I got to make sure that I got this, and I got to do that, and it was just very, very complicated. And I couldn't figure out why life was so hard to live. And it wasn't until I got here that I learned that about the age of 13, the God that I had understood, I got him and I put him in my back pocket. And the only time that I used him was when I used to say, let's make a deal. And I got caught or whatever. And I would tell, oh, man, get me out of this one. And I'll change. And I won't do it no more. And, you know, everything I told him. And he would always keep up his part. And I would always say, oh, sucker. Because I'm going to go back and do it again. True. You know? That's the truth. You know? I mean, I found that out after I came here. You know, he was the one that I feared, but did I really fear him? I'd say in the end of me, on my drinking and using other chemicals, I didn't want to die, but I was willing to. In the morning, when I got up and I had to do whatever I had to do to get whatever I needed, was going to get done. You know, and by that time I was already by myself, and I liked it like that, isolated. You know, I can say I've got this big family, and I would stay away from them. The last 5 years I remember staying away from them. I wouldn't go to no kind of birthday parties. I wouldn't go to no barbecues, nothing like that. And I got invited, but I always thought, well, you know, they don't want me around because I'm the one that always, you know, has to go take care of their business first and then come there. And if I run out, then I got to go and go take care of more business. Or, like I said, what kind of party is it if somebody hits somebody? You know, what kind of party is it if, you know, hey, somebody says, hey, go and get a breath of fresh air outside, okay? And it's your best friend's old lady. Okay? I don't know about you, but those things that I said, I didn't say, hey, I'm not going to do those things. I know better. And I did them. You know? And so not to feel that, I kept putting all that stuff in my body. So when I got here, I was pretty dead inside spiritually. I just didn't know that's what was wrong with me. I just knew that everything that I used stopped working. The last 4 or 5 months before I got clean and sober, they wouldn't work no more. I couldn't get rid of that guilt. I couldn't get rid of that hurt. I couldn't get rid of that remorse. I was too much of a coward to get a pistol and put it in my mouth and blow my head off. Because that's what I felt. But I couldn't do that. But I did a lot of other suicidal things. Robberies with no guns. Knowing, you know, I mean, who's going to go rob a place if you don't got a gun or a knife? You know, hey, that's pretty stupid. You know, the second step says here, you know, that our insanity will be, you know, returned. You know, we come to believe. And I remember hearing that second step, and I kind of thought, I'm not insane. What are they talking about? You know, I'm not crazy. There's nothing wrong. You know, because when I think of that word, I think of an individual in a jet straitjacket, you know, all strapped up in Patton State Hospital or Camarillo or Napa, someplace like that. That's what I think about. You know, but after I came here and I got a sponsor and I started working the steps and they told me, you know, what insanity was, and I had to look at it. I had to look at it for what it really was. And I always expected different results. And I kept doing the same thing. You know, they kept telling me, You know what? That's a brick wall. You can't run through it. And I kept trying to run through it. And even after they told me, you know what? If you go to the side over there, there's a door. And it's got a knob on it. If you turn it and you open it, you can go through it. It's a wall. Oh, hell no. I'm going to go this way. That's insane. That's insane. But like I said at the time, I couldn't see that. I'm going to talk a little bit on the first step. Because I believe that's a step you have to do perfectly. Okay? That first step is the first step you have to do perfectly. And the principles that are there, the spiritual principles that are there, that I've come to learn that... And I know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say the key is acceptance. But before I can get to that spiritual principle of acceptance, there's four others that I got to work in that first step. And the first one is, I have to admit. I have to admit. And in order for me to admit, the spiritual principle that I have to work is honesty, self-honesty. Not to any of you, not to none of my family members, not to nobody, but to me. I am an alcoholic. This is what I am. When I do that, I'm able to work the second one. Okay? And that's open-mindedness. And I have to, with that self-honesty, it allows me to open my mind. I have to admit, I'm powerless. My mind is now opened up. I'm powerless. Because before I came here, surrender? I don't think so. I got beat a few times with handcuffs on, and I still didn't surrender. And I would never surrender. Because in my mind, I would say, I'm going to have these handcuffs off, and I'm going to get even. And I'm going to get you. Not your friend, not go break the windows in your car, but I'm going to get you. That was my belief system. So when I heard here that I had to surrender, that just... like, really threw me, like, wait, what do you mean surrender? Can't do that. But like I said, it wasn't until I did that first step, like I said, I self-honesty, I admitted. My mind opened up that I am powerless. And what am I powerless? Okay. After I did this too, I was able to become willing, that I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm now self-honest. My mind's opened up. I've been able to get willing, have the willingness. Because the next step, the next spiritual principle that I got to work, I got to humble myself. And my life is unmanageable. And I have to admit that. My life is unmanageable and it always will be unmanageable as long as I run it. And I have to humble myself to do that. See, I don't know about any of you, I don't like to say that I don't know what I'm doing. Because that don't sound good. Because my biggest character defect is sound good and look good. Still today. Alright? And a crowd like this, hell yeah. My ego is the one that says, I want to look good and I want to sound good. I want to be the best one looking here. I know that. A character defect that I have to work on. I'm honest. I'm willing. Open-minded. I'm willing. I've not humbled myself. And now I can accept what I am. I can work the last spiritual principle, acceptance. This is what I am. I'm powerless over my alcoholism, and my life is unmanageable. That was the key when I first got here. After staying here for a while, this is the step that I go back to over and over again. Because when I start running into that brick wall, I forgot to tell you, I still like to run into that brick wall. Okay? With no kind of chemicals in my body. I don't have to, but occasionally, when life on life's terms shows up, I still want to. Okay? Because I want to do it my way. I have the power. And my life isn't unmanageable because I'm running it. Okay? See, and I can't do two, or I can't do three, and I can't do four. I can't do none of those steps. You can't do none of those steps. And they say, well, which step are you working in this situation? Well, guess what? You can't work that step in that situation and then you surrender whatever the situation is about. And that you need to get out of the way and let God do what He has to do. I know that. A year and a half, this is life on life's terms. I get a phone call. And be careful what you pray for. I've had a boy that's been incarcerated and as long as I've been working on my recovery. Okay, at that time, and I've been wanting him home. Well, he came home and came out of a level 4 penitentiary, and so I thought, hey, life's going to be wonderful and great. You know, it's January, it's after the New Year's, and he goes to a nightclub, and he calls me, and he tells me, I've been shot. Okay. And I'm okay. Don't worry about me. Okay? I'm going to go to a friend's house and they're going to take the bullet out of me. Okay? Bye. Click. And my first thought is, man, you know, I know he's coming from Porterville. I know he was in Porterville. I know he got shot out down the road. He gives me details, but I don't know what's going on. And the very first thing, like I said, is I want to run against that brick wall. I can make a phone call. I know where I can go get a gun. You know, all these things come in first into my head. You know, they've harmed my child. You know, man, I'm thinking, because this program has allowed me to think. That's another luxury I got today. What am I doing? I'm running with my will, and my will are my insane thoughts that are in my head. Okay? And so I have to surrender. I have to believe that my insanity can be restored, and I've trusted the God of my understanding, my will in my life. So I have to give it to Him. And what do? I start praying. About 45 minutes later, He calls me. He tells me I'm on the way home. Okay? He's got my ex-wife's car. He gets to my house. He's got a towel on his back. He's got a shirt, a light powder blue shirt that I let him borrow, this shirt. Full of blood. Got a hole in his back the size of my thumb. Okay? And he's telling me, I don't want to go to the hospital. And I have to tell him, you know, look, son, you can go to the prison and you can get out of that hole, you know, but you can't get out of the hole 6 feet underground. That's one hole you can't get out of. You have to go, you know. You didn't do nothing. They shot at you. You know, and I'm running now with what I've been taught here. But the God that I've come to understand is going to take care of me. So I get him in the car, I take him to Cuya Delta, and there just happens to be the doctor that's on call right there just happens to have about 2 or 3 weeks that's been transferred from Glendale, from the hospital there, Martin Luther King Hospital. And look, that's a specialty gunshot. You know, and lucky enough, and this is spying about a quarter of an inch, he shot with a Glock 40. I stood there and watched him take the bullet out of him. Because they gave him a local and he came in from the side. And the bullet went in the kids and came in from the top. And I seen him. And I seen my son and all the pain he was going through. And I happened to have a shirt on from the other fellowship. And the doctor seen it. And he's telling me, how long have you been bleeding? And I tell him. And he goes, what's going on in your mind right now? I go, a lot of things. That's my boy there on the ground. That's my boy right there. Somebody hurt him. See, now I want to take my will and my life back. And I want to go hurt somebody. And I don't care if I got to go to prison the rest of my life. Because I know how to live there. I know that. See, because my insane thinking still tells me that I can go do the rest of my life behind prison bars if I have to. Not that I want to. But if I had to, I could. See, that's insane thinking. That is insane thinking. So, once again, I have to revert to that first step. I have to give it up. I have to surrender. But I have to remember that if I do things my way, I am powerless over this situation. In my life, if I start running, it will get unmanageable again. That insanity will kick in. I'll take over my will in my life. Okay. I'll have a plenty of a new four-step to write. Okay? I got plenty of wreckage to put on there. Right. And then I'll have to, of course, go to that fifth, let somebody know. This way, I know the fourth step is what I've done, and the fifth step is why I do it. And the sixth step, my character defects. Once again, all my character defects which are up here. My thinking. I know all my character defects lead up to one. Fear. Fear. That's my number one character defect. Okay? Because like I told you, my biggest character defect is look good and sound good. What is that? Fear. Man, are these people going to think I'm okay? And you know, what's going to happen? It goes back to fear. I know that. What that allows me to do is look at my shirt for me. Of course, that's the action. You know, you don't like the way I look? All right. Like what I've always done. Okay. You don't like how it is? Well, then, this is the only way I know how to deal with that. I don't have to do that today. This same boy that this happened almost a year later, he lifted his hand to me. Okay? And he barely grazed me. And he wanted a physical altercation. I told him, I'm not going to hit you. Because I hit the same boy at about 60 days clean. And at that time, that was my best earning skill. We were in my El Camino, and I was picking him up from Packwood School, and he had a baseball cap, and he was trying to be a gangster, and I pulled the car over, and I told him, get off, you're going to be a gangster? And he slapped, bitch slapped him, and I knocked him out of the face. So, that's how you treat gangsters. Want to be a gangster? I said, those were my best earning skills there. Okay? I had 60 days clean. But the important part of that story is that after I did that, I wanted to go drink some tequila so bad. Because I felt so bad. I felt like a piece of shit. Because my disease told me, you be a father, you're worthless. And you're always going to be worthless. So when this altercation happened about maybe 8 months ago, I didn't hit him because I also knew that I come from a place that if I hit you, I'm not supposed to let you get up. And I fear that more than anything else. But I won't stop hitting him. And that'll hurt him. Son or no son. That's not a good thing. See, and out of that altercation, I would be the one who get more damage than anybody else. I would kill that human spirit, the little bit that I've got today, has been eaten, I will kill it by my actions. And of course, step 8 never closes. That step is always open. Okay, because I don't know about you, you know, I don't got nothing in me, but hey, I still once in a while tell people things that I shouldn't, and they don't even have it from me. Okay? So I have to keep that list open because I still have to put people on there. And of course, 9 is when I get that freedom, when and wherever I can make those amends and not injure myself or nobody else. It ain't going to do, I have another little character defect. I like to go out with married women and have fair commitment. Okay? So when I did my 4th step, I told my sponsor, so I'm supposed to go to my friend's house and go tell him, hey, you know, so many years ago I was going out with your lady. He goes, no, you don't do that. That ain't going to fix nothing. You might get your head blown off, and, you know. So I do that in different ways. I make an indirect amends. And I still to this day, I don't know why things with rings come at me. And I have to decline the offer. You know. Because once again, I know I will get harmed. And 10, 11 is love. I have to promptly admit my wrongs. I have to promptly admit my wrongs and then correct them. And the most important part to that is stop doing the behavior. Okay? Because if I don't stop doing the behavior, it's no good. That's like what I used to say all the time before, I'm sorry. I'm sorry don't mean squat. Every time I said I'm sorry, and of course, 11, keep that conscious contact. And I do that. I don't leave my house, I don't care if I'm late, without saying my prayers. And when I lay my head down to sleep, I thank him. I don't care how the day is brought in. Okay, because I've buried my mother here. Alright. I got my oldest son in prison right now still. And that one that got shot right now currently is running from 187. This is life on life's terms. This is my wife to say, you know what? But this is the best life I've ever had. Because I got peace and I got serenity. Through everything that I'm talking about, I know I'm going to be okay. And before coming to this program, I never thought I was going to be okay. I always thought I had to do something for that to happen. And sometimes the biggest thing that I have to do is that I have to get out of the way and not do nothing. And that's hard to do. Very hard to do. And of course, 12, carry the message. You know, do that 12-step call. I get a call today from an individual that was in the other program and thinks she can just drink, right? And so that's come, I don't really associate with her much. But she calls me today and she tells me, oh, I need to talk to you for that. I said, well, you know what, I can't go over there. I end up going. And she's telling me about a teacher friend of hers and another lady that I know that, oh man, look at their strung out, they're doing this, but I only do a little bag just once in a while and I only drink. I'm not like them. I tell them, you're the one that's more in denial than anything. They thought what they are. And all I could do was tell her, you know what? When are you going to start getting busy in the business of living? Because right now you're in the business of dying. You got a 9-year little boy that he's making all kinds of strides, you know, and he's doing good. And you think you can drink. And you don't think it's going to catch up to you. And I know that's a lie. Because this disease, all it wants to do is get me by myself and kill me a little bit at a time. And with that, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to share with you my experience, strength, and hope.